A culture's worldview tends to go hand in hand with its literal worldview, with its visualization of the world it inhabits. When the crew of the Apollo 17 mission brought home this photograph, it became an instant icon. There are several reasons for that. The Apollo program was the first space program that carried a photographer far enough from the Earth to make full Earth photography at all possible. In fact, and this may surprise you, but no human being has been sufficiently far from the Earth to take another such photograph since 1972 when this shot was taken, because there has been no manned mission since then to anywhere but low Earth orbit, which is like space for losers. All the full Earth photographs that you have seen that were produced after this date were taken by unmanned spacecraft or stitched together from multiple satellite images. So given how difficult it is to take an actual handheld photograph like this one, it is not hard to see how its publication in 1972 brought a new vividness to our knowledge of our place in the universe. Interestingly, that new vividness almost instantly took on a political quality. Because what do we see in this image? We see a world that is predominantly blue, a world without humans, an atmospheric system of high and low pressure zones that functions just fine without human intervention. It took a flight to the moon to be able to look back at our home planet and realize that it is so much more than just our home. The effect the image had something to do also with the spirit of the age, to be sure. The 1970s were a time of environmental awakening. The post-war automobilization of the West had led to such fumes of congestion that people had come to question whether this was still a desirable development. Some of the first landmark studies on past and present climate change were also published in the 70s. Above all, there were growing calls around the world for nuclear disarmament and, increasingly, the abandonment of nuclear power. And this led to the formation of green parties all over Europe, followed in the mid-70s by the first animal rights movement of our time. In short, people became much more conscious of the environment they inhabited. In the midst of all this, people first caught sight of photographic proof of what the Earth looked like from a distance. This is not the only shot that was made, although it is the first to show the Antarctic. Ironically, it doesn't show any of the countries representative of the culture that took the photograph, and it shows none of the countries that were calling the shots on the global stage at the time. Instead, it showed its Western audiences what else is there, and represents an important stage in our shift of focus away from ourselves and towards the global ecosystem as a whole, a shift that had begun in the 18th century with the questioning of religious dogma and the development of the theory of selective evolution in the 19th. So which is which? Does the photograph owe its existence to the growing environmental consciousness, or did the photograph inspire that consciousness? I imagine neither is true exclusively, but the fact that this photograph went on to become one of the most widely circulated photographs of all time, the selfie to end all selfies, makes clear that we identify with this image. It strikes a chord with us, and the fact of its wide distribution accordingly says something about our culture. These things are no different from medieval cosmography. If images like this one circulated widely in the Middle Ages, that tells us a great deal about their worldview. The strict division of the known continents by means of the Mediterranean, the Nile, and the Don River suggests a segregated identity, at least as perceived by the cartographers involved. Asia is not just considered the largest continent, it is also at the top of the picture, suggesting preeminence. When Isidore of Seville described the world in words in the 6th century, he mentions Asia first, Europe second, Africa third. This ordering and the design of this map may be explained in large part from religious considerations. Jerusalem is the center of the medieval worldview, and accordingly it is found at the center of most medieval maps, representing holy ground, but also the meeting point of the three continents. In much the same way, of course, modern maps as used in the West have Europe as their horizontal center. At the easternmost point of the world, at the top of the map there, was Eden, the terrestrial paradise, now beyond our reach, but still there as the cradle of all humankind and as a reminder of what we should strive to regain. Finally, not everyone who used the map like this believed that these three continents were all there was to the world. Many knew the world to be spherical and held this region here to occupy only the front half of the northern hemisphere, or a quarter of the whole world. But the fact that the rest of the world was either unknown or unknowable meant that the focus was to be squarely on these three continents, and on their landmass, obviously, not the oceans that feature so prominently on that photograph from 1972. So today then I'd like to address some of the following questions. First, what cosmology preceded and informed the medieval worldview? What is the geographic understanding of the world found in ancient, medieval, and specifically Anglo-Saxon literature? What were medieval maps of the world like? How do the Anglo-Saxons describe the world and their own region? What about their neighbors? Where lay their horizon and what did they imagine existed beyond it? How did they, but more specifically, their northern neighbors, the Scandinavians, navigate? What is there by way of Anglo-Saxon travel literature? And finally, what are the dangers of approaching medieval literature using current geographical tools? There'll be five parts to today's lecture, starting with the question of what came before. In hindsight, Greek antiquity was a terrific time to try out crazy new ideas about the universe and the laws of physics it observes. Over the course of a few centuries, mostly from the 6th to the 5th century BCE, a number of philosophers and theorists may be found defending hypotheses that were each other's exact opposites. On the one extreme, Parmenides and Zeno of Elea held that the entire cosmos, everything that exists, is one substance. The impression that this table and I and you are different entities is pure illusion. And since everything is one substance, change is impossible, and motion does not exist. That may sound pretty outlandish to you, but Zeno has some pretty good arguments to support his belief. Consider an athlete running a race, as in this image. In order to complete the race, he first had to get to the midway point. And once he gets there, it is possible to then cut the remaining distance in half again. And it is fair to say that he again has to get halfway to the finish line from his new position before he can move on. Once he gets to the second midway point, he has a third midway point to meet, and a fourth, and so on, ad infinitum. And so the runner is faced with an infinity of tasks, which is more tasks than anyone can manage in a finite lifetime. This means that the runner can never actually reach the finish line. If it seems he does, that must all be an illusion. Another variety of the argument runs as follows. If Achilles raises a tortoise, but the tortoise starts out with a lead, Achilles must first get to the tortoise's original starting point before he can begin to overtake the tortoise. But once he does reach that point, the tortoise will have again gained a lead, and Achilles once again will have to catch up before he can overtake. Once again, we end up with an infinite number of tasks, and so Achilles can never overtake the tortoise. It's all a lie. On the opposite end of the spectrum, we find Heraclitus, who held that everything flows. Nothing is stable, including our own identities. We both can and cannot step into the same river twice. And in much the same vein, we both are and are not, because we are a constellation of particles in flux. I, who end the sentence, am not the same person who started it. There's actually a lot of uncertainty about the details of Heraclitus' position, since, as with so many early Greek thinkers, we have only fragments of his thought as reported or paraphrased by later Greek philosophers. But Heraclitus' position seems to have some things in common, at least with that of the atomists, a school started by Leucippus and Democritus, who held that all that exists is atoms and void. What we think of as larger order entities, such as this table or myself, is either an illusion or a temporary coupling of atoms. In turn, atomism has a fair bit in common with modern materialism, the belief that all that exists is physical. So at least this is a school of thought that we may be able to relate to more easily. But a neat little corollary of atomism is that if atoms are all that exists, everything must have a physical cause. And in Greek atomism, this was sometimes taken to mean that everything is determined by a single causal chain, so that there is no free will of any kind. The first cosmic whirl that sends atoms flying apart determines every last event in the cosmos right there and then. Now, some of these great minds of Greek antiquity also expressed opinions about cosmology in the sense of astrophysics. For instance, several of them attempted to explain what makes the Earth stay in its place. None of them had really clued into the fact that we are not stagnant as a planet, but are on a death race around the sun at the speed of, I think it's 30 kilometers per second, and that the sun itself is flung around the universe at 200 kilometers per second. But in their defense, it's not exactly noticeable by looking out the window. But if the Earth were standing still, this would have to be explained, because we don't see anything propping it up. Thales held that it floats on water. At least that's what Aristotle reports, and he does not provide further details of Thales' position. Anaximander, perhaps more helpfully, explained that the Earth is at the center of the universe, and that it bears similar relations to bodies in all directions. And it is this symmetry of relations which keeps it in its place. A number of other thinkers of the period held that the Earth is a disk, so large that, much like a kite, it floats on air rather than cutting through it. According to Plato's dialogue Phaedo, Socrates preferred Anaximander's theory about Earth being held in place by relations to other bodies, and that seems to have been one of the more successful theories in the end. The shape of the Earth was another topic of contention. Now, people like to cite Homer in this context. I do feel compelled to point out that Homer was a poet, and as a wise person once said, we shouldn't trust poets. But just for reference, Homer depicts the Earth as a flat disk, bounded by an outer ocean. His description of Achilles' shield is a nice, concise, poetic depiction of the world, ending in the lines which Alexander Pope translated as follows: "Thus the broad shield complete the artist crowned, with his last hand and poured the ocean round. In living silver seemed the waves to roll and beat the buckler's verge and bound the whole." That's poetry. In the realm of serious thought, Anaximander held to the belief that the Earth is cylindrical. And not just cylindrical, but specifically, he said, on the basis of who knows what, that the height of the cylinder must be about a third its perimeter, or its diameter, rather. So he must have been a fan of curling, I guess. Pythagoras understood the Earth to be spherical, but it was another 3 centuries before Aristophanes estimated its circumference. He was able to do so with the help of information about the position of the sun during the solstice at different latitudes. How close he got exactly to the actual circumference of the Earth depends on what distance he meant by a stade, because there were different standards. So either he was really very close, or at least he was sort of roughly in the general ballpark. As we saw, Anaximander held that Earth occupies the center of the universe. Not all that much later, Philolaus, a follower of Pythagoras, came to the conclusion that in fact Earth orbits, wait for it, a central fire, which is also orbited by the sun. We never see this central fire, but that's just because the Earth doesn't spin around its own axis, and the habitable part of the world is turned away from the fire. Given this system, though, the existence of lunar eclipses forced Philolaus to posit a counter-Earth, which orbits the central fire opposite from the Earth's position, much as in Lars von Trier's film Melancholia. The counter-Earth may also have served to counterbalance Earth's mass. This theory actually came to be understood as the standard Pythagorean cosmology. By the 3rd century BCE, Aristarchus developed this Pythagorean system into a heliocentric system, so with the sun at the center. But that's not an idea that didn't really catch on for another 2,000 years. Another Pythagorean idea that did gain currency was that of the harmony of the spheres. Pythagoreans believed that the various heavenly bodies related to each other in musical ratios, combining into heavenly song that, unfortunately, we cannot hear. Now, many of the thinkers discussed so far lived in the 6th and 5th, early 5th centuries BCE. That's prior to Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. We accordingly refer to them as pre-Socratic philosophers in a nod to the significance of Socrates' thought and the schools founded by his students for the development of Western philosophy generally. A lot of the earlier cosmology was collected, vetted, and further developed by the 4th century philosopher Aristotle. He was a student of Plato who had himself been taught by Socrates. In his work On the Heavens, written about the year 350 before current era, as well as scattered around his other texts, Aristotle describes his understanding of the cosmos, building on a number of pre-existing theories. According to Aristotle, the universe is spherical, nesting, and geocentric. We are just not talking about planets that are suspended in space orbiting one another independently. Instead, each planet is a visible part of an otherwise invisible ball that contains, encapsulates Earth, like a set of Russian dolls of which the innermost doll is Earth. This view was arrived at because the so-called fixed stars, those are the stars that we're familiar with, appeared not to move relative to each other, but their total set does move relative to the Earth-bound observer. Accordingly, it was inferred that they must all be attached to a sphere encompassing the sphere of the Earth. That sphere itself is invisible, but we see the stars. They're like decorations. Aristotle furthermore said that the universe consists of five fundamental physical elements: earth, water, air, fire, and ether. He then divides his universe into celestial and sublunary. All that exists below the sphere containing the moon, so all that exists in our world, consists of just four elements, while the heavenly bodies furthermore contain ether, which preserves them from corruption, setting them apart from our world, which is the only part of the universe that is subject to decay. Aristotle explains all motion in the universe through an unmoved mover, a first principle so divine that the heavenly bodies move out of desire for it. But because the universe is spherical and takes up all space in the universe, the only motion that results is rotation. The final Greek thinker I'll mention is the one who influenced medieval astronomy and geography more directly than any of these other ones. Ptolemy, an Egyptian scholar, lived in the 1st and 2nd centuries of our era and wrote an important manual on astronomy known as the Almagest. Based on Aristotelian cosmology, this work describes the motions of all the visible heavenly bodies. Like most Greek texts, it was not available in the West until the High Middle Ages, but it did leave enough of an impression to affect medieval astronomy indirectly. Now let's get back just slightly to the 1st century before our era. Latin culture was in full bloom, and Cicero was one of its foremost representatives in writing. One of his works of particular relevance to our undertaking today is a work called De Re Publica, The State. Of its 6th and final book, very little survives, but the bit that does is its conclusion, known as the Somnium Scipionis, the Dream of Scipio. That part was itself lost throughout the medieval and Renaissance periods and rediscovered only in the modern era. But this dream also came to exert an indirect influence on medieval cosmology and dream theory. The Dream of Scipio is a dream vision not unlike that experienced by Catmon in Anglo-Saxon tradition. The dreamer in this case is the Roman soldier Scipio, and the time at which he experiences his dream is when he has come to fight in the Punic Wars. In his dream, he encounters his dead grandfather by adoption, who foretells Scipio's political and military successes. Among other things, He will conquer Carthage in the rank of consul in just 2 years' time, and then he will rise to the rank of dictator. His grandfather also points to the importance of duty and of serving justice. The perspective of the dream is celestial, providing an elevated view of the city of Carthage, but also encouraging the dreamer to see earthly affairs in a cosmic perspective. It is important to point out exactly what schools of thought are here brought together, since this brief vision would end up profoundly determining medieval cosmology. The work includes an Aristotelian account of the cosmos, describing geocentric, spherical, nesting universe with the sun, stars, and planets attached to spheres encapsulating Earth. It contains the Aristotelian idea of five climate zones. This is the notion that there are two Arctic zones that are too cold to sustain life. There is one equatorial torrid zone that is too hot to sustain life. And then there are two remaining moderate zones, the northern one of which we occupy. There is also the Pythagorean idea of the harmony of the spheres, repeated in this dream. And then finally, there is the metaphysical idea that virtuous human souls live in the Milky Way. You may get a sense of the tone of this dream from this excerpt. This is the grandfather speaking. He says, "Follow justice and natural affection, which, though great in the case of parents and kinsfolk, is greatest of all in relation to our fatherland. Such is the life that leads to heaven and to this company of those who have now lived their lives and released from their bodies dwell in the Milky Way." And as I surveyed them from this point, this is now the dreamer going on, all the other heavenly bodies appear to be glorious and wonderful. Now the stars were such as we have never seen from this earth, and such was the magnitude of them all as we have never dreamed. And the least of them all was that planet which farthest from the heavenly sphere and nearest to our earth was shining with borrowed light, that is the moon. But the spheres of the stars easily surpassed the earth in magnitude. Already the earth itself appeared to me so small that it grieved me to think of our empire, with which we cover but a point, as it were, of its surface. The celestial perspective in this text serves above all to point out limitations to fame. After all, you can acquire fame in Rome, but the world is so much larger, and the universe much larger still. The greatest virtue is to be had by serving one's fatherland, but the end goal of such virtue is not fame, but an everlasting life in the Milky Way. You can already tell that this text doesn't need much adjustment to make it palatable to Christians. As I mentioned, the dream of Scipio was lost in the Middle Ages, but not before a 5th century Roman gentleman by the name of Macrobius produced a commentary on it. In it, he leaves the politics of Roman antiquity out of consideration and focuses on two things in particular: the meaning of dreams and cosmology. This work ended up defining both these fields for much of the Middle Ages. Following both Cicero and the fashion of the 5th century, it infused these fields with a Neoplatonic flavor, which combines very well with the tone of the original dream. Its cosmology likewise remains strongly Aristotelian. The illustrations on this slide traveled with the commentary and depict on the left a lunar eclipse and on the right a solar eclipse. This image likewise traveled with the text and shows the geocentric cosmos with the spheres of the moon, sun, and other planets encapsulating Earth. Within his commentary, Macrobius ended up relaying a great deal of Greek thought to the Western Middle Ages, specifically a geocentric universe. This was pretty common in Greek antiquity, but it still wasn't the only theory in existence. Then the spherical nesting universe that we saw with Aristotle, which revolves in response to what the Neoplatonists come to call the world soul. Aristotle's five elements are reduced to four. Fire is used as an equivalent to ether. Earth, obviously, is spherical. There are these five climatic zones, which, by the way, are visible here in this image. So the blue zones are the ones that you can inhabit. Now, the fact that there are two inhabitable zones that are separated by an uninhabitable torrid zone in the center means that we can never reach the other inhabitable zone. But in theory, it could be populated by humans like ourselves. These we call the Antipodes. And in fact, Macrobius said that there's Antipodes not just in the southern hemisphere, there's also a back to this Earth, which we cannot access because there's too much sea in between our continents and the next continents over. So there's hemispherical Antipodes and there's southern Antipodes. The three continents that were known were Asia, Europe, and Africa, and they were surrounded by an outer ocean. That is what kept us from making it to the other side of the planet. But also there was thought to be an equatorial true outer ocean, which you can see follows the equator here, between the northern and the southern hemispheres in the torrid zone, which makes it even harder to get to the southern hemisphere. In case anyone here present still doubts Macrobius's understanding of the shape of the Earth, let's read this passage. It comments on that line that we read from Cicero that says, some stars were visible, which we never see from this region, etc. Macrobius comments, in adding the words, which we never see from this region, he adequately explains why some of the stars are not visible to us. Our abodes lie in such a position that certain stars can never be seen by us because that portion of the sky in which they move can never appear to us who live here. This quarter of the earth, the Latin says pars, this portion of the earth, let's say, which is inhabited by all the people with whom we can have any contact, verges towards the North Pole, and the spherical shape of the earth causes the South Pole to be plunged into the depths. So this passage clearly states that the earth is spherical, and in addition, it makes explicit the understanding that we can access, at best, half the world. The southern hemisphere is cut off because of the torrid zone and the equatorial ocean, but as I said, in Macrobius' understanding, there's also the back to the planet, which we cannot reach for the vastness of the ocean. And it was indeed several more centuries before Europeans developed the techniques needed to cross over to the back of the hemisphere. And so to Macrobius, we can only access a quarter of the world. And that world is dominated, or that part of the world is dominated by a landmass of three continents, Asia, Europe, and Africa. Now let's have a closer look at the tradition of cartography. Anaximander, who was already mentioned, is held to have been the first to publish a map of the world in the 6th century BCE. His actual map was lost. We've been able to reconstruct it with help of Greek derivatives and descriptions. These reconstructions look remarkably similar to medieval maps, actually, namely circular. In Anaximander's understanding, of course, the circle represents the top of his cylinder. Whereas in medieval tradition, it depends first of all on what sort of a map you're looking at. The TO map, as we call it, to the left here, is circular in the first instance because the landmass it depicts was thought to be circular in shape. In a Macrobian understanding, you have to understand, this map depicts not the whole world, but only that quarter, the knowable world. The map to the right is also Macrobian, but it illustrates the five climate zones and attempts to show us the three continents of our part of the world inside it. As you can see, he hasn't managed to make those quite circular, which goes a long way to demonstrating that it's quite hard to really bring these two understandings of the world together. But the reason why this map as a whole is circular is because it shows as much of the spherical Earth as is visible from just one vantage point. There's just as much Earth around the back, but you can't see it in a two-dimensional image. And at any rate, Macrobius held that we cannot access it. On today's maps, we represent the entire Earth in a two-dimensional map using a trick known as map projection. And that projection comes with the trade-off that countries at higher latitudes look much larger and a little mal-shapen compared to what they really look like. So we actually end up with really unrealistic notions about their relative size and shape. Let me show you how that works. This is a puzzle online with the typical Mercator projection that we use nowadays, in which these red blobs are countries that are dislodged, and the puzzle consists of you putting them back in place. But as you can see, when you move these countries towards higher latitudes, they change shape quite dramatically. That thing at the top there is Australia. Okay? If I drag it back to where it belongs, it looks about a third, maybe half as large as Greenland. But when I bring it back up to Greenland, it looks to be twice, three times its size. That thing just to the south of Australia there is Iceland, by the way. I drag it up, again it grows. And the further I drag it, the more it grows. That thing down here by Madagascar is Finland. Again, it grows as I bring it further up. So that just goes to show that we don't really have any idea of the relative size of these countries. We're being fooled all the time. So in some ways, medieval world maps are more honest than today's. The words used to refer to the medieval world may be of some interest in this respect as well. Latin authors speak of the orbis terrarum, the circle of lands or circle of countries. Old Norse sometimes uses heimskringla, which is a literal translation of the Latin. In Old English, we get middanjerd, which is typically translated as middle earth, though that's not technically correct because the second element in that compound is not erd, earth, it's jerd. Jerd, like Old Norse gardr, means enclosure, and by extension it comes to refer to anything contained within an enclosure, such as a garden, that's where that word comes from. And finally, a home, a dwelling, and also a region or country. So middanjerd then means the middle region or middle dwelling. Middle dwelling still leaves the question in the middle of what? The 19th century dictionary by Bosworth and Toller calls it the middle dwelling between heaven and hell, which is one possible interpretation, but I believe we had better look for clues in a few adjacent traditions and in Old English literature itself before making things up like that. First of all, to bring out the point that there is more than one way to situate a middle world, we may look at the Finnish word maailma, which literally means land sky. So the point where land and sky meet, that's a different kind of middle dwelling than suggested by Bosworth and Toller already, even if they may have had a similar spatial configuration in mind. But Old Norse actually has a word directly corresponding to middanjerd, namely midgardr, which in some of the mythology is contrasted with an útgardr, or outer region, which in turn is enclosed by the úthaf, or outer ocean. So there's a middle region, and an outer ocean. This conceptual field then seems to suggest that the middle dwelling is in the middle in the same way that the ocean lies around things. And that is an image that not just harks back to the Latin orbis terrarum, but also that is commonly reflected in Old English, that is also reflected on medieval world maps like these ones. In addition, we get a sense of that same spatial ordering in Old English poetry quite frequently. So it's possible that that is what is meant by the poetry as well. Let's look at a couple of examples. In the poetry, we often get this phrase, be sam tweonum. It occurs repeatedly in Beowulf, and as you saw in your article that you read for this week by Hyatt, Beowulf off the map, this is often taken to mean between the seas or between two seas. The tweonum part is often rendered to, but actually what's going on here is that we have between, that's the preposition between, that has been split up to make place for the word sea. So it really says be seas tween, right? So it's an open question on whether you want to render the two parts literally or as part of between. So then it means either by the two seas or between two seas, or just between the seas. As Hyde points out, in the case of Beowulf, there is a case to be made for reading it in a local sense between the two seas, because Beowulf takes place in Sweden and Denmark, which are both located between the Baltic and the North Sea. But it shows up also in the poems Guthlac, A and B, which are set in England. Oft we overseon bisam tuenum Theoda Theowas. And Guthlac is called the best person, bisam tuenum, of which we've ever heard among the English. So is he now the best person that we, between the two seas, namely the Irish Sea and the North Sea, have ever heard of? Or is this, once again, a superlative? Because that is what Hyatt says about the usage in Beowulf. We get bisam tuenum wherever someone is the best of something, right? We have Selestan besam tuenum, the best one, the best man, the best person between the seas. Which would tend to suggest that really this may not be a local use, it may refer to the entire world. And in fact, there's more evidence for that. Because if we look at Exodus, we even find it there. This is the poetic rendering of Exodus, which says, Ye yisitath besam tuenum of Egypte. They inhabit the land between the seas down to Egypt. Yisitath siriche besam tuenum. They occupy the land between the seas victoriously. And that would suggest that indeed this is a more universal use, that it doesn't refer to any two seas, it just refers to the land amidst the outer ocean. That is also the sense that we get from another expression, swa water bebuyeth, as the water encompasses it. This is, again, a phrase that we find in the poetry. In Beowulf, it says, the Almighty One created the earth, established the glorious plain as the water surrounds it. So clearly, he's talking about all the landmass. Swa sida, swa sa bebuyeth. We find a more limited use of this phrase or a similar phrase once in The Death of Edward, which is a late poem, a eulogy to King Edward, and it says that he governed the Angles and the Saxons and the Welsh and the British, swa umklipath kjelde brimmas, as the cold waves enclose them. So in that case, we're looking at just the British Isles. But Andreas, a text that we read a few weeks ago, has Jesus saying to his disciples, now travel to the four corners of the earth as wide as the water surrounds it. So clearly this is about the entire world. And in fact, that phrasing, once again, is very similar to what we get in Orosius, that geographical treatise that you looked at for this week, which says that the ocean lies around this world. So then it seems likely that midanjerd, the Old English word, should be understood in the same sense intended by the cartographers as well, namely the landmass that is surrounded by the ocean. The world was thus visualized on a Macrobian basis. It lay at the center of the universe, the land surrounded by an outer ocean and the globe itself surrounded by a series of spheres holding the planets and the stars. Zooming in on planet Earth, what we tend to see is this TO map that you've already seen twice by now, so named because the continents of Asia, Europe, and Africa are separated by the water of the Mediterranean, the Nile, and the Don River, which, if abstracted into a single body of water, form a T, provided that we place the east at the top of our map, as was customary because that's where paradise is. The combined landmass and encircling ocean, but above all the shape of the map itself, form an O. TO maps were the most popular subtype of what we call mappae mundi, singular mappa mundi, sometimes written as one word, meaning simply world map. Let's just look at a couple of examples. This is a 7th century map from northern Italy. Well, it's a reconstruction of one, simplification, of course, a pen drawing. As you see, the Nile is not so clearly brought out here so that it doesn't look like a T quite so much. But if we zoom in, we have all the normal parts. Way at the top, there's paradise, which looks a little bit like a volcano here. And if you look just south of paradise, it says Eremus in Transneabilis, an impassable desert. So we can't actually get to paradise, which is why we're still in Germany. We go to the other end of the map. We find here the British Isles. Both Britain and Ireland in sort of an oblong shape. Ireland seems to have sailed some way, of course, from its normal position, and they're both very close to Spain, which is interesting. This is the Anglo-Saxon world map. It is not round. It's from the 11th century, but everything else is where you would expect it. Once again, at the top, I can't make out what it says there, but that should be paradise. We have here the Arabic Peninsula, which is way, like, it's the easternmost thing in the world, right? So it's all a little warped. I'm not sure, by the way, why we have three colors of water. We have blue and green. Maybe the green is fresh water, or maybe those are mountains. And then there's red as well. Now, there's more than one, so it's not just the Red Sea. We go to the center of the map. We have the Mediterranean with lots of little islands, and Jerusalem here, the center of the world. And once again, at the western edge, we have the British Isles, this time a little bit more realistic in shape. At least there is Cornwall, although Cornwall is a little oversized. I think the cartographer was overcompensating for something. Ireland is in its regular place now, but again, they are really close to Spain. And Spain itself, like Brittany, is said to be part of Spain. So it's still a little bit different from our maps as we make them today. Here's another English map. This one's from the 13th century, so it's not Anglo-Saxon. Notice the shape of the material here, by the way. The fact that it is sort of house-shaped means that they have used every last inch of the vellum that they could. So they took the animal, a calf in this case, and they used as much of the skin as they could in order to fit as large a circle as possible onto it. I'm not going to zoom in to this one, but I will show you a pen drawing version of it that should make clear that we have, again, Jerusalem in the center, we have a little island at the top that must be paradise, and then we have the British Isles here on the edge. You can probably tell from the absence of detail on these maps and from the massive inaccuracy that these maps were not used for navigation. Instead, they served the encyclopedic function of showing armchair geographers what their world looked like. In addition to maps, armchair geographers also had access to geographical treatises, which, thanks to the scalable nature of prose, at least had the potential of being more accurate, more detailed, perhaps more practical in nature. We'll see how they hold up in that regard in a moment. We'll then gradually make our way to questions of navigation. As so often this term, we start this new section with reference to Bede. Bede's ecclesiastical history was, of course, a work of religious historiography, but it is about the inhabitants of a particular place, and so quite naturally, he starts out by describing its geography. He writes, "Britain, an island in the Atlantic, formerly called Albion, lies to the northwest, facing, though at a considerable distance, the coast of Germany, France, and Spain, which form the greatest part of Europe. It extends 800 miles in length toward the north and is 200 miles in breadth, except where several promontories extend further in breadth, by which its compass is made to be 4,875 miles. To the south lies Belgic Gaul. To its nearest shore, there is an easy passage from the city of Rutebi Portus, by the English now corrupted into Rettichester. The distance from here across the sea to Gesoriacum, the nearest shore in the territory of the Morini, is 50 miles, or as some writers say, 450 furlongs. On the other side of the island, where it opens upon the boundless ocean, it has the islands called Orcades." All right, so clearly we have here a quantifiable map in words. Notice how Bede says that Britain lies opposite Spain. That sort of checks out with the maps that we saw, right? Now, at this point, it seems appropriate to tell you about the Old English Orosias, part of which you've actually read for today. I have also mentioned it a number of times before this term and explained that Paulus Orosius is actually the name of the work's author, even though we tend to use it as the title when we refer to the Old English text. The proper title of the work in Latin is Historia Adversus Paganos, History Against the Pagans. It's a Latin work from the early 5th century that takes Augustine's work, The City of God, as its inspiration and model. King Alfred had it translated into Old English in the late 9th century, and tradition has it that he, in fact, played a personal role in its translation, which may very well be accurate. Of course, the history laid out in this work is not itself Anglo-Saxon or even Northern European, but much like Bede's work, it opens with a geographical introduction to the known world. That introduction does take Northern Europe into account, but since Orosius spent his life around the Mediterranean, Northern Europe was not exactly his forte, and so Alfred made use of his own superior knowledge of Northern Europe to improve on Orosius' geographical introduction. The revised section on Britain then reads as follows. The island Britain. It extends a long way northeast. It is 800 miles long and 200 miles broad. On the south of it, and on the other side of the arm of the sea, is Gallia Belgica. And on the west part, on the other side of the sea, is the island Hibernia. And on the north part, the Orkney Islands. Ireland, which we call Scotland, is on every side surrounded by the ocean. And because it is nearer the setting of the sun than other lands, the weather is milder there than in Britain. Then on the northwest of Ireland is that outmost land called Thule, and it is known to few because of its great distance. Thus have we spoken about the boundaries of all Europe as they lie. Do you see anything funny about this description? And I don't mean the allegation that Ireland has a milder climate because it's nearer the setting of the sun. And I'm also not referring to the reference to Thule or Iceland, which, by the way, is always interesting when they do mention it, because Thule was known into the Greek world, but it was so far away that you never know when they say Thule whether they mean Iceland or Norway or something else entirely. But what else is funny about this compared to the slide that we just saw with the excerpt from Bede? Does anything strike your eye? Same measures, that's right. So they must be basing themselves on the same material, or one is the source of the other, right? Bede actually would have known Orosius' text. But there's a difference as well. It's related to those measures. Where Bede says that Britain stretches 800 miles to the north, the Old English Orosius says that it stretches toward the northeast. Now, we check that against a modern map. We find that Bede is right. The island's western shore is rather in line with that longitudinal line that we find here, right? So it's pretty much north-south, whereas the eastern shore is more north by northwest, but certainly not northeast. Had Britain had a northeasterly orientation, it would have ended up off the coast of Denmark. And scholars have been aware of this for a long time and tried to puzzle it out. Kemp Malone puts it in these words, "In fact, if we take the west side of Britain, a line from Land's End to Cape Wrath in Sutherland runs almost due north, while on the east side, a line from Lowestoft in Suffolk to Peterhead in Aberdeen runs northwest by north. But in Ptolemy, we find Britain extending northeastward until it ends in the point north of the mouth of the Elbe and almost in sight of Jutland." Orosius doubtless had similar misconceptions, and Alfred does not seem to have known much better. Alfred goes on to say that Britain has Gallia Bellica to the north, to the south, and Hibernia to the west. The southerly rather than southeasterly location of Gallia Belgica is an inevitable consequence of the notion that Britain extended northeastwards. For the same reason, we must interpret Alfred's west as equivalent to our northwest. In other words, Alfred's term of direction here shows a shift of 45 degrees clockwise. This curious fact becomes even more curious if we continue reading Alfred's account of Northern Europe. Because the bit that you read about this Norwegian named Ochtar, which in Old English becomes Ochtere, he once made it to Alfred's court and said, I live up in Norway, and he tells Alfred that he'd once sailed around the North Cape and into the White Sea, just to see what he would find, but also for reasons of trading. Alfred ends up interpolating this entire account into Orosius' geographical introduction. We there read that Ohthere first sails due north for 3 days, and then he continued due north as far as he could reach in the second 3 days. There the land turned due east, or the sea penetrated the land, he did not know which, but he knew that he waited there for a west-northwest wind, and then sailed east along the coast as far as he could sail in 4 days. There he had to wait for a due northern wind, because there the land turned due south, or the sea penetrated the land, he did not know which. Then from there he sailed due south along the coast as far as he could sail in 5 days. So, by mouth of Ohthere, the Old English Orosius provides it with a very detailed picture of how to sail around the North Cape and into the White Sea. But nearly every sailing direction we get is off by about 45 degrees, as demonstrated by these red lines on the map here. So how are we to understand this? Scholars have been trying to figure this one out for over a century now. Early scholars, like Kent Malone, concluded that there must be some Nordic way of navigating that was always 40 degrees or 45 degrees off compared to the magnetic north. But later scholars have taken issue with Malone's argument. For one thing, as Malone himself points out in the argument, in the excerpt that I quoted, the Egyptian Ptolemy and the Roman Orosius got it wrong too, with regard to Britain at least. Secondly, the aberration is not everywhere consistently 45 degrees. Malone seems to be reading the evidence in his favor there. And thirdly, the aberration is found also in parts of the Middle East, where neither Ohthere nor the Anglo-Saxons had much sailing expertise. So let me share with you one highly plausible solution that was put forward by a scholar named René Dérollet. Dérollet's solution is based on the recognition that if we look at a mappa mundi like this one from Anglo-Saxon England, Alfred's orientation doesn't seem so strange. Because compared to the equator down there, Britain does indeed seem to be at an angle. But why is that? That seems to be because the map assumes that the North Pole is a point on the leftmost extreme. So, just as we may be fooled by the proportions and shapes of modern maps, because, you know, Greenland looks so much bigger than Australia, but it isn't really, the question is whether the map's readers in the Middle Ages were aware that they were looking at a point north map. It may have been a common mistake to assume that the entire leftmost edge is the north, and that therefore, for England or for Britain to be a north-south country, it would have had to point directly to the left. Dérollet therefore hypothesizes that the Old English Orosius translator made use of a map like this one and fooled himself into corrupting nearly all of Orosius's directions. Significantly, this also explains why not all of Alfred's aberrations come to 45 degrees exactly, because it is the countries nearer the edge that will have the greater angle between map north and perceived north, as you can see here in my red lines, because the red line nearer the edge has a sharper angle than the one that's nearer the center. Both Britain and Norway are on the edge and thus approximate 45 degrees of aberration. As you've read in Hyatt's article, the Anglo-Saxons and their neighbors, notably the Scandinavians, did not have a compass for navigation. So then how did they navigate at all? How do you navigate without a compass or GPS? Any ideas? Sun and stars. That's right. So the stars, of course, can be used for a very precise orientation because you know exactly where they are. The sun can be equally precise if used in combination with a sundial, which is illustrated on this stamp from the Faroes here, because pieces of such sundials were actually found in the Arctic, as used by Scandinavians. The idea here is that it's a is a horizontal disc, right? You hold it horizontally, and then there's a stick called a gnomon that sticks out, and it casts a shadow onto the disc. Now, if you were to, for instance, the Icelanders, when they sail to Greenland, they would always sail by the 61st degree northern latitude. And you could make a carving in your disc that would sort of trace the pattern of the sun, like the length of the shadow of the gnomon during your voyage. And then whenever the shadow didn't match up with the notching, you knew to correct your bearing. Actually, some scholars have recently reconstructed how this works, and they describe it as follows. A stick, the so-called gnomon, was mounted into the wooden disc, perpendicular to the disc. If the disc was held horizontally at latitude 61 degrees north during the sailing season of the Vikings, which ran from May to August, and the sun was shining, then the tip of the shadow of the gnomon cast onto the disc followed the hyperbolic carving from sunrise to noon to sunset. Straight and hyperbolic carvings corresponded to the equinox and the summer solstice, respectively. After carving the trajectories of the tip of the gnomon shadow into the disc, the Vikings gained an instrument, the sundial. With it, they could locate geographical north along latitude 61 degrees from May to August, even on the high seas, provided the sun was shining. All they needed to do was to hold the dial's disc horizontally into the sun and rotate it around its vertical axis until the tip of the gnomon shadow reached the corresponding carving on the dial. A notch on the disc then showed the geographical northern direction. But as becomes clear from this description, using the sundial requires sunlight. Navigating by the stars requires a starry night. So what options did the Vikings have available to them when, as will often happen in the North Atlantic, the sky was overcast? That one's harder, right? We have a few ideas, but we're not too sure. Firstly, it has been suggested that they would have made use of the migratory patterns of birds and whales. Both can be very reliable indicators to the knowing eye, and birds, of course, have to head for land, at least, whatever they do. But we have no written sources confirming this practice. What we do have is some very limited written evidence of a mysterious instrument known as a sunstone. Our main source for this, for the use of this sunstone, is a short story called Rodulfsthauftr, the story of Rodulfr. So consider the following scene. The weather was cloudy, and it was snowing, as Seidr had said it would be. Then the king had Seidr and Dagr called to him. After that, the king had someone look around outside, and there was no clear sky to be seen anywhere. Then he told Seidr to say where the sun had got to. He, Seidr, gave a precise indication. Then the king had a sunstone brought out and held it up, and he saw where the beam of light pointed from the stone, and it pointed in exactly the direction that Seidr had said. Just a little bit of context here. Seidr in this story is a seer, and on the preceding day, he had foretold today's rather unusual snowstorm. So the king's request is to be understood as a further test of his abilities. He asks Seidr where the sun is at a time when it is invisible. Seidr tells him, and then the king verifies this information using a sunstone. When he holds it up, a beam of light points to the location of the sun. And that's as much information as the saga will give us. Now, it is not very hard for physicists to reconstruct some version of the practice here referred to. Sunlight is subject to a phenomenon known as sky polarization. Aerosols scatter the electric field of the sunlight as it travels through the atmosphere. And that's also what accounts for the fact that the sky is blue in the daytime but red at sun up and sunset. Because during those times, the light has to travel a longer atmospheric distance to your eye, and so there is more scattering. This phenomenon is known as Rayleigh scattering, and we know that insects use it for navigation, so theoretically, humans should be able to do the same, given the right tools. Since this scattering always takes place at an angle of 90 degrees from the source of the light, All you need is a way of making the polarization visible, and then you can determine the position of the sun. A polarizing stone will do the trick. The Iceland spar in this picture is an example of a polarizing stone. So now, when the sun is not directly visible, the sunstone can take its place in navigation. When used alongside the sundial, you can navigate as per usual. But there is a catch, or several maybe. Firstly, there still needs to be a sun, so you cannot use it at night, or even when the sky is completely overcast, as in the text. Dense fog also would render it useless. These scholars have actually tried that out. Also, as noted, Rayleigh scattering is particularly prominent, particularly strong, during sunrise and sunset. And that means that it is during the twilight hour, in particular, that this effect may be utilized for navigation, although twilight at those latitudes takes a long time. The scientists who reconstructed the technique describe it as follows. They say, by rotating such a crystal to and fro and looking at the sky through it, the sky appears to brighten and fade periodically. The Viking navigator could calibrate the sunstone by adjusting it in such a way that a patch of the clear sky appears brightest. A line pointing to the true position of the sun would then be scraped into the crystal. After such calibration, the direction of the sun, hidden by clouds, can then be determined by looking at a clear patch of sky through the crystal and rotating the latter until the sky appears the brightest. The scratch on the sunstone then shows the direction of the invisible sun. So now we know how people got around prior to the development of the magnetic compass. Let's have a quick look at how they described the lands and peoples they encountered, or perhaps more accurately, claimed had been encountered by a friend of a relative. Let's start with the Old English Orosius, since it is in fact a Northern European travel narrative with a comparatively high degree of reliability. Alfred inserts two Scandinavian travel narratives into his version of the geographical introduction of Orosius, that of Ohtere, who has traveled around the North Cape and into the wide sea, and that of the Dane Wolfstan, who has traveled around the eastern Baltic. Ohtere on his journey encounters two peoples, the Beormas and the Finnas. Both are said to live in the northernmost part of the region around the wide sea. Both, Ohtere claims, appear to speak very similar languages. The text says, it seemed to him that the Finnas and Beormas spoke almost the same language. His main reason for going there, apart from exploring the land, was for the walruses, because they have very fine ivory in their tusks, and their hide is very good for ship robes. Now, all this information checks out. These ethnonyms, Beormas and Finnas, are translated from the Old Norse, where we encounter them as Bjarmar and Finnar. The latter, the Finnar, are what we now call the Sami. Back in the 20th century, we'd call them Lapps, the reindeer herders of northern Scandinavia. And their very similar language may have been a Finnic language, like the Sami spoken by today's Sami, although you can't entirely rule out that Ohtere could have encountered Slavic speakers. Ohtere's references to trade in ivory and hides also fits well with our evidence from Old Norse sources. Many texts attest to the existence of Finnar, Bjarmar, and a third category known as Kvenir in this region, and a few confirm the existence of trade between them and the Germanic Norwegians. Let's look at this passage from the early 13th century Ale saga, whose first 27 chapters tell of a family who held the royal right to collect tribute for the king from the Finnar, the Sami, and engage in trade with them. We read, in the winter, Thorolf made his journey up unto the fell. He had a good deal of wares with him. He soon met with the Finnar and collected their tribute and held a trade meeting with them. It all happened in peace and friendship, but occasionally with the lubricant of intimidation. And a few chapters onwards, it was stipulated in law among the Kvenir, that's another category of individuals inhabiting the distant north, that the king should receive a third of the share of plunder, as well as all the bear hides and sable martens and askraka off the top. Now, we don't actually know what askraka means. It only occurs in this one text. It must be some sort of animal or animal product. People have speculated it might refer to some species of squirrel. But these passages do corroborate Ochter's claim that there was trade between Germanic Norwegians and their neighbors to the north and east, and also that trade goods in these parts were mostly animal products like hides and tusks. Things get just a little more suspect in Wolfston's account of the Estonians. There is a custom among the Este, we read, that after a man's death, he lies indoors, uncremated, among his relatives and friends for a month, sometimes two. The king and other high-ranking men remain uncremated, sometimes for half a year. All the time that the corpse lies indoors, it is the custom for there to be drinking and gambling until the day on which they cremate it. And a little while onwards, we read, there is a tribe among the Este that knows how to cause cold, and this is why the dead men there lie so long and do not rot, because they keep them cold. Now, this is one of those cases where one suspects there is some grain of truth at the bottom of this, but something must have gone funny along the way. I can certainly believe that if someone died in November, for instance, they would put off the cremation until the spring thaw. In fact, there are cemeteries in places as familiar as New York State that today still postpone all burials until the spring, because it is hard to dig a grave in winter. And indeed, throughout the Arctic, from the Sami to the Inuits to various Native American nations, the custom is to expose corpses above ground rather than to bury them for exactly this reason. As for the Estonian situation, one could, of course, make use of the natural cold by digging a pit house or grubenhaus, whose floor level lay a little below the ground so that you could keep your food fresh. These buildings were common in Anglo-Saxon England as well, but Estonia being colder than England, they would simply be more effective there, as the topsoil in Estonia freezes up more commonly than in Winchester. 6 months' worth of feasting once again sounds more than a little suspect, but that's the sort of misunderstanding or embellishment that tends to attach itself to stories about faraway places. Which reminds me, the words misunderstanding and embellishment do not cut it when describing the medieval Alexander tradition. Alexander the Great certainly must have seen some exotic sights on his ambitious campaigns into Persia and India, and they would have seemed considerably more exotic to contemporary Anglo-Saxons who had never even been to Greece. But the accounts that survive in the several medieval texts associated with his name bear no relation to the historical Alexander. To medieval authors, Alexander the Great was simply the perfect romance protagonist because you could legitimately insist on his historicity, yet he was far enough away in space and time that no one could check whether the stories you made up about him had any truth to them. The letter of Alexander to Aristotle and the wonders of the East are two examples of a tradition that would map strange creatures to distant eastern regions, making clear how little people really knew about Asia, while at the same time exhibiting an interest in unknown parts of the world, or at least an interest in the exotic. In the text known as The Wonders of the East, or The Marvels of the East, it is both strange humanoid creatures and strange animals that are described. I'll give you some examples. In one land, there are born donkeys, which have horns as big as oxen. They are in that very great wasteland, which is in the southern part of Babylonia. They retreat to the Red Sea because of the multitude of snakes, called corsii, which are in those places. The snakes have horns as big as rams. If they strike or touch anyone, he immediately dies. In those lands, there is an abundance of pepper. The snakes keep the pepper in their eagerness. In order to take the pepper, people set fire to the place, and then the snakes flee down into the earth. Because of this, the pepper is black. So you see, there's a degree of etiology going on there. They're explaining why things are the way they are. Why is pepper black? Because in order to get it, you have to burn the earth. Ants are born there as big as dogs, which have feet like grasshoppers and are of red and black color. The ants dig up gold from the ground from before night to the fifth hour of the day. People who are bold enough to take the gold bring with them male camels and females with their young. They tie up the young before they cross the river. They load the gold onto the females and mount them themselves and leave the males there. Then the ants detect the males, and while the ants are occupied with the males, the men cross over the river with the females and the gold. That story calls to mind the riddle of how to get a fox, a chicken, and a bag of grain across a river if you can only, you know, bring one passenger at a time. So clearly, these were pressing concerns in Anglo-Saxon England as well. The manuscript that contains the Wonders of the East, and by the way also the letter of Alexander to Aristotle, also contains Beowulf, which, as you learned last week, is known as well as the Noel Codex. And this codex, in some of his texts, including the Wonders of the East, has illustrations of these objects of ethnographic study. For instance, this is a specimen of the Penotii, a people with ears so long that they reach to the ground. If they want to run, they have to pick them up, as in the illustration here. The text further explains that the Penotii, when they go to sleep, use one of their ears as a pillow or mattress and wrap themselves in the other one for warmth. And it goes on. There are people born there who are 15 feet tall and have white bodies and two faces on a single head, feet and knees very red, and long noses and black hair. Then there is an island, south of the Brixantes, on which there are born men without heads, who have their eyes and mouth in their chests. They are 8 feet tall and 8 feet wide. Dragons are born there who are 150 feet long and are as thick as great stone pillars. Because of the abundance of the dragons, no one can travel easily in that land. Now, the reference to a land full of dragons where no one can easily travel is tellingly similar to a land described in one of the texts you'll read for next week, Solomon and Saturn II, one of the dialogues. It's also awfully convenient to describe a land that no one can enter, since it makes it impossible for anyone to falsify your outrageous claims. The same is true of the postulation, of course, of a torrid zone that could not be crossed. You can make up pretty well anything about the people living on the other side of that zone, because no one can test your account. This boundary, by the way, is referenced even in the Old English verse paraphrase of the Book of Exodus. When the Israelites pack up and march out of Egypt, we read the following. Nerwa yunuddon on Norwegas, wiston hembesudan sielwaraland, for barnet burchleadu, brunaleode, hatum hervon colum. Far haligod with far brunefold yeshulde, balche overbradde, burnende hervon, haljanette, hardwende, luft. Difficulty forced them, the Israelites, onto the northern paths. They knew the land of the sun people to be to the south. The mountain slopes scorched and the nation brown from the heavenly coals. Holy God shielded the people against the terrible blaze there. He covered the burning heaven with a beam, the torrid air with a holy net. In the biblical version of this narrative, the Israelites are preceded by a pillar of cloud. In the Old English retelling, God covers them with a screen, sort of an umbrella, to keep them from burning up in the heat of the sun. Now, Alexander became a legendary figure in all of the monotheistic traditions. In the Talmudic tradition, he discovered the terrestrial paradise. A version of that story actually made it to the West as well, but not perhaps until the late 12th century. Alexander was, in fact, taught by Aristotle in his teenage years. Aristotle, as mentioned, was barely known in the West in Anglo-Saxon times, since almost none of his writings had made it into Latin. They would be translated via Arabic in the 12th century, when Spain was under Arab rule, and also about that time translated directly from the Greek. But the knowledge of a connection between the legendary king and the sage philosopher did make it to the West. And a letter was confabulated along the way, supposedly written by Alexander and addressed to to Aristotle. This letter occupies a middle ground between The Wonders of the East and National Geographic magazine, inasmuch as it involves actual exotic animals in its depiction of the wonders experienced on a journey through India. Alexander's camp is, for instance, overrun by a rhinoceros, something that could in fact happen. Not in India, but that geographical name was quite liberally applied. The latter is mostly an account of the dangers and afflictions of wild camping. There came suddenly one very huge beast, bigger than the others. That beast had three horns on his forehead and was fiercely armed with those horns. Once the beast had drunk the water, it saw our campsite and immediately attacked us and our campsite. It was not put off by the burning of the hot fire and flame that was in its path, but it went and trod on everything. Then after that, there came horned serpents, the kind of serpents called Carastis. They were all of different colors, some red, some black, some white. On some of them, their scales glittered and shone as if they were gold when one looked at them. And the whole country resounded with the hissing of the serpents, and we had no little terror of them. But we shielded ourselves with our shields and slew and killed them with long-shafted spears, and many also burned in the fires. We endured these things to the extent that we were fighting and struggling with the serpents for fully 2 hours of the night. In short, they have a terrible night of it, interrupted by dangerous wildlife every hour or so of the night. When the daylight finally returns, Alexander responds to these inconveniences like a true colonial white man, punishing his guides no end in the morning. When it was daylight next morning, I ordered all my guides who had led me into such hardships to be tied up and their bones and legs broken so that they might be devoured that night by the serpents on their way to the water. And I also ordered that their hands be cut off so that thereby those might experience torment for the torment into which they had knowingly led and brought us. The marvel literature of the Alexander tradition may be understood on the one hand as sort of a freak show, a showcase of the permutations of sentient life that the medieval imagination could dream up. And on the other hand, as in the letter to Aristotle, it could be understood as romance, a series of adventures in an unfamiliar and therefore exciting setting. Romance is not an Anglo-Saxon genre, really. Secular romance exists only in the letter, and in Apollonius of Tyre, a Greek romance that made its way to Anglo-Saxon England via the Latin. The sort of stories that were to become so popular from the 12th century onwards, of knights riding off into unfamiliar forests in search of adventure, these have no clear counterparts in the Anglo-Saxon tradition except in the few imported works. Although there are some further instances in the religious literature. Specifically, Andreas recalls the marvels of the East tradition in that it tells of a journey into an inaccessible and hostile Eastern land populated by humans that aren't quite humans as we know them. In this case, they are cannibals. That text, too, is based on a Greek source. But what matters is that all these texts were translated and copied in Anglo-Saxon England. So they came to contribute to the Anglo-Saxon worldview. The same is true of this TO map. And the two traditions, the narrative tradition and the cartographical tradition, of course, combine into a single discourse. This world map, simple though it may be, tells us a great deal about how the world was understood. And it sets out all the conditions for romance as well, with Jerusalem in the center and paradise at just about the farthest point from England, with Asia as the largest, and yet the least known part of the knowable world, it beckons adventurers to go explore these remote places, whether in the name of the cross or in the name of adventure. And many Anglo-Saxons did, in fact, make it to Rome as pilgrims. Some may have made it even further abroad, whether on pilgrimage or as traders, but apart from a number of correspondences in Latin, their accounts do not survive. Judging by the surviving corpus, Anglo-Saxon authors were not a class that did much physical traveling themselves. though we also don't see England playing an especially prominent role in their writings. Instead, in their creative imagination, they traveled mostly to the Holy Land and to the Mediterranean, where saints battled it out with demons in order to regain their spiritual homeland in the afterlife. About the same time when the majority of Old English manuscripts were produced, about the year 1000, that is, their northern neighbors, the Icelanders, using their sundials and perhaps their sunstones, first made it to North America. They first caught sight of it when drifted, of course, in a storm on their way to Greenland. Eventually, they returned west to investigate, and they accomplished a major seafaring feat when they became the first Europeans to set foot in North America, probably in and around Newfoundland. This photograph is from L'Anse aux Meadows in northern Newfoundland, where people have found pieces of jasper believed to have been sourced in Iceland and Greenland. Jasper was used to make fire, used by the Scandinavians specifically, not by the Native Americans. The reconstruction we see here, by the way, is not based on local archaeological finds. Those have been very limited. This is really more of a fantasy of what a more permanent settlement could have looked like. The Vikings indeed made it all through the North Sea, through much of the North Atlantic and the Mediterranean, and down the Volga and through Rus territory into the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea. They were the most ambitious northern European navigators of the pre-modern period. But they, too, fantasized about far-off cultures. On the one hand, they produced a wealth of romance or adventure narratives in a homegrown Norse genre in which individuals travel to eastern or northeastern regions populated either by the wizards of the Finnar or by giants. On the other hand, they too relayed the European marvels of the East material. And in fact, they ended up marrying this tradition to their own seafaring history. Because in the saga of Eric the Red, which tells of the discovery of North America, but was written down centuries after the event, we find not only accounts of encounters with Native Americans, accounts that are not unlike those that were written by European pioneers in the 18th century, we read also of spottings of humanoid species that surely derive from the marvels of the East tradition, including a uniped, a person with just one leg. We read, "One morning, Carlos Epni and his men saw a speck above the clearing, glimmering at them, and they called out at it. It moved. It turned out to be a uniped, and it ran down to the riverbed where they lay. Thorvaldr, son of Eric Rödi, Eric the Red, sat at the rudder, and the uniped shot an arrow into his small intestine. Thorvaldr drew out the arrow and said, 'There is fat about the abdomen. We have found good land, and yet it may be that we'll hardly make use of it.' Thorvaldr died from his wounds a little later." That's how you're supposed to die in Icelandic tradition, right? Using understatement. The fact that both more romance and more travel literature survives in Old Norse than in Old English is not to say that the Anglo-Saxons lacked imagination. We should remember, above all, that the Old Norse material was written down 4 or 5 centuries later than the Old English material, in a very different literary climate, when many laymen were in a position to produce their own literature. Lay literature is what is largely and sadly missing from the corpus of Old English, and so we should be thankful that some such texts, including several of next week's elegies, survive at all. On this week's secondary texts, Alfred Hyatt's article, Beowulf Off the Map, let me say only this. All I need you to take away from it is the following. Firstly, an understanding that the Beowulf poets, and by implication most other Anglo-Saxon poets, did not refer to a mappable geography the way modern scholars perhaps might like to see them. Instead, Hyatt speaks of a chorography, a regional and emphatically literary topography of places without clearly quantifiable relationships to each other or to the rest of the world. Secondly, I want you to understand that As Hyatt explains in the final section of his article, the history of Beowulf scholarship has been heavily influenced by the national backgrounds and political interests of early scholars, as Swedes, Danes, and Germans have sought to claim the poem and its hero for their own heritage. Accordingly, it is more fruitful to read the poem the way it was written, namely, without reference to a map. If we read Beowulf as sort of a romance, akin to the Middle English romances, maps suddenly seem pointless, and we come back to reading Beowulf as literature, as Tolkien long ago suggested we should. Do have a closer look at Hyatt's article. It is an excellent introduction to both medieval, early medieval cartography and also literature. But I do want to make this second point here a little more relatable. What if I were to ask you, how would you draw a map of the story of Little Red Riding Hood? You can't really. You can't because no real world hides behind a fairy tale. And it would be pointless, misguided, and counterproductive to try and reconstruct one. And so as we move on next week to the world of Old English Elegy, let's not try to reconstruct where the poet of the Wanderer grew up. Let's read environment as literature and see where that takes us. Thank you.